Hey, it's time for Stay Human, so buckle your seatbelts, set the cruise control at something reasonable, and turn the radio way up. We're going for a ride. Cole's cover of The Boss. Coming up in this hour, we'll have music from Prince, Wilson Pickett, Amy Mann. Maybe we'll even get some Beach Boys in there if they've got any good car songs. I'm Michael Goldberg, driving around in my 20-year-old black Nissan. The body is not what it was, and it never was all that great. And the electrical system, forget about it. But that 3.5-liter engine still can get me up to speed. It's a Maxima, which I guess has got way better pickup than a Mini. It's no Magnum nor Mustang, but at least it's not a Kia Elantra. What the heck is an Elantra anyway? Some kind of reptile? Car names are the poetry of consumer madness. On wheels with spinning rims. Can't you just see yourself in a caravan or in a crossfire, an avalanche, the Outback or the Outlander? Drive a Durango to Hyundai Santa Fe or to Mercury Monterey. It's easy credit and we're clearing the lot. Suburban to town car, Pathfinder excursion. You could be a Cavalier, a Raider, a Phantom, a Charger, a Sprinter, or a PT Cruiser. Back in the 1950s, Ford Motor Company hired the famously inventive poet Marion Moore to come up with some names for their new models. She took the commission. I mean, you know, Ford Motor Company. She studied pictures of cars that they were developing, and after a while, she suggested Utopian Turtle Top, Intelligent Bullet, and Mongoose Civic. Marion Moore, of course, lived in Manhattan. She took cabs everywhere she went, never drove. So, of course, she didn't quite get the rhythm of the road. Ram the Passat and Impala Corolla with Stratus and Jeep Liberty for all. On today's show, we have a car story cycle from Pat Coffey. Scott Stoll finally breaks down and buys himself a new used car. And we get a lesson on how to get good karma in your car. It's a brag fest, really, and I hope you're feeling good about whatever you're driving these days. We'll start out with this poem from St. Paul-based poet Robert Daugherty.
My car runs pretty good, knock on wood. All things considered, I figured I'd keep it. It's a dark coffee brown. As I travel through town, I wonder, is the chassis strong? And how long will I hold the road? Avoid the pothole. Call for a tow. Hard to know. Winter snow has a way of changing tires. Engines start fires. But my car has seat warmers under me and over ice, which is nice. So I get up and go down the road slow in my car.
In the fall of 1973, I was 27 years old and had never owned a car.
Carolyn King.
My father, who was a car collector of sorts, had lent me a 1967 Mercury Monterey convertible that was as big as the Queen Mary that I sailed from coast to coast, ending up in Washington, D.C. A few months later, I called my father and said, I want to buy a car. He queried, well, what kind are you looking for? And I responded, a Volvo, a Mercedes-Benz, or a Dodge Dart, because I had been told they were good cars. A few months later, he called from Grand Forks, North Dakota, to tell me he thought he had found a car. I immediately said, okay, is it a Volvo, a Mercedes, or a Dodge Dart? He said he'd been out walking that morning in an alley behind the El Rocco Bar and had found a Dodge Dart that was up on blocks. We purchased it for $150, paid a mechanic friend $350 to get it running, and on June 28, 1974, I saw my Robin's Egg Blue 1966 Dodge Dart convertible for the first time. It had 92,097 miles on the odometer. That summer, I put 3,000 miles on the Dart, driving over every mountain pass in Colorado, and then took off for the West Coast. We spent a year driving up and down the hills of San Francisco, and then went coast to coast, ending up back in Washington, D.C., where my friend Robert taught me how to change its oil every 2,000 miles. During the 3 years we were in the nation's capital, I drove it from North Carolina and as far north as Maine, where a moose nearly charged the Dart in Baxter State Park. In January 1979, I drove the Dart back to North Dakota for the winter. We spent the spring driving on parts of Route 66 and ended up that summer in Virginia Beach, Virginia. In the fall of 1980, the Dart and I finally moved back to Grand Forks. When the North Dakota winters became too severe, I found a 1974 four-door Dodge Dart, so I had my winter Dart and my summer Dart. When the winter Dart, eventually died, I found a 1966 four-door Dodge Polara that was the same year and color as my Dart. How could I resist? The Polara became my winter car, and I called it the Dart's dad. It was also as big as the Queen Mary, but I never felt safer on snowy roads driving that gas hog Polara with its 318 V8 engine. August 19, 1988, the Dart and I were driving Highway 2 to Duluth for a co-op meeting. The Dart broke down at Jack's Amoco station in Grand Rapids. A guy came in to gas up his Corvette, saw the Dart, we struck up a conversation, and a year later to the day, we were married, and I moved myself and the Dart to Grand Rapids. The Dart is now my mine pit car, and I drive it every summer to go to the mine pits for my daily swims. It has driven U.S. senators and Sweet Adelines in parades. There's a guest book in the glove compartment that everyone has to sign when they ride in it. Frequently, when I'm at a stop sign, a guy will pull up beside me and ask if I want to sell my car. My standard response is, "Buddy, there are only two ways you're going to get this car from me. Murder me or marry me." The next thing I hear is their tires screeching into the intersection. I've owned the first car I ever bought for 46 years. It now has 310,700 miles on its original slant six engine, and I still change the oil every 2,000 miles. I love my Dart.
Thanks to Carolyn King for sharing her pride and joy. Carolyn's a volunteer here at KXE, and all summer long, everyone in town knows exactly where she is because they see that Dodge Dart convertible parked at the mine pit or cruising through Grand Rapids. Here's another summer car, this one from Duluth poet Connie Wanick.
Every 1st of May, he'd wave goodbye at the end of the driveway as he took his summer car, the coral-colored Bel Air, for a spin. It must have made him nervous out on the public road, but also proud. A guy like me in a car like that. He had to live the whole winter, all those salty miles up north that corrode a steel body. For what? Same as everyone else. But a few things are too good to ruin. The shine on a fender meant a certain feeling came flooding back, 100 proof. He knew the star of every moment was, on closer inspection, another sun. Within one life, a man is many. So he felt. Still, as he turned the key, he thought, this is the real me.
Summer Car by Connie Wanick.
Should know by the way you popped your car sideways that it wouldn't last. It's the other kind of person that believes in making out once, love them and leave them fast. I guess I must be dumb, cause you had a pocket full of horses, Trojan and some of them used. But it was Saturday night, I guess that makes it alright. You see, what have I got to lose? And money I jockeys that were there before me. Believe it or not, I started to worry. I wondered if I had enough class. But it was Saturday night, I guess that makes it alright. You say, baby, have you got enough gas? Oh yeah, little red Corvette. Baby, you're much too fast. Yes, you are.
Whenever I spot my friend Carolyn King in her Dodge Dart convertible, I'm always a little bit jealous, just like practically everybody else. I used to have a Dodge Dart, a sedan. I loved that slant six. It was the last car I ever owned where I could look under the hood and actually understand and be able to see what was going on. Didn't need a computer to diagnose it. Which was a good thing, because as it was rounding a couple of 100,000 miles, there were plenty of roadside coat hanger duct tape liquid solder repairs that needed to keep it running. We had bought it when we were living in Brooklyn because we realized we needed some way to get out of the city on a summer weekend. It wasn't so easy, though, owning a car in the big city. For one thing, the first few times I drove it into Manhattan, I would walk away on this brightly lit street without turning off the headlights. They were always outshone by the streetlights and the store marquees. Had to flag down a cab driver, pay him $10 for a jump so we could get started and get back over the bridge where we belonged. And then I had a worse kind of battery problem, too. For a few months, I'd come down to the street, slip the key in the ignition, and nothing, because during the night, somebody had come along and stole my battery. Then it happened again. I tried parking where I could see it from my apartment window and sat up late into the night, try to catch him. I wound up buying a chain and padlock for the hood, which worked after I had bought about 3 batteries in a couple of months. It made it a little inconvenient, though, to top off the oil or to get a jump. Parking, though, that was the worst of having a car in the big city. I tried, but with no success, to emulate my brother-in-law, Howie. He lives in Oakland now, and that's plenty crowded enough, but he was in New York City when I moved there, and he had this superpower, although he just calls it parking karma.
I know, and that's another thing. You just know it inside, and you have to have this inner belief that you will find the parking spot, and it does happen. It happens for me. It happens for my daughter, Shayna. And I'm glad it doesn't happen for everybody, because then I'd be up Schitt's Creek. And when we go someplace together, it's like, okay, like we go to the ice cream parlor. Now, that's on Piedmont Avenue. It's always hard to find parking on Piedmont Avenue. We both find parking almost immediately, and we're within inches of, you know, where we're going. So, you know, who's closer? I don't know. It's that's the way it is. It does happen that way. It's amazing. In the 1980s, early 1980s, when I was living in New York, I had a car. Big mistake, but I had a car. It was a small car, a Volkswagen Bug. And they have something in New York City called alternate side of the street parking, so that every day you have to move your car in order for the sanitation trucks to come by and clean the streets. That puts a tremendous amount of duress for people who have to move their cars, because you have to find a spot on the other side of the street where the sanitation department's not running. And, of course, all those spots are taken. So you drive around the blocks, around the neighborhood, around the city, looking for a parking spot. The universe is paying me for all the grief I went through in New York, going up 72nd, down 73rd, up 74th, down 75th, up 76th, down 77th, for hours, you know. So I put my time in, and karma is, you know, just getting it returned. That energy that I put in, it's like a bank. You put money in the account, at some point you start withdrawing. That's kind of what it is. I've been withdrawing for a long time.
Howie Kirsch, not quite ready to hit the brakes on his karma. You tune to The Car Show on Stay Human. This universe works in mysterious ways. You might sometimes tell yourself that you are in the driver's seat, or you might think you can let yourself off the hook because you're just a passenger. But here's Chris Smithers' take on it. His song, I Am the Ride.
are loosely fitting, jury's still our city. Sense of duty keeps us all in motion. Prison sirens wailing that security's failing do not inspire a lifetime of devotion. No one will sympathize, no one really tries. They need a faith that leads them like a drum, and I can hear it pounding down among the ruins. Sad to say, I don't think I'm the only one. Someone spoke, they asked me in a whisper if all my dreams and visions had been answered. And I don't know what to say, I never even pray. I just feel the pulse of universal dancers. And they'll waltz me till I die, they'll never tell me why. I never stop to ask them where we're going. The holy, the profane are all helplessly insane. Wishful, hopeful, never really knowing. If I believe, and do the angels really grieve, or is it all a comforting invention? It's just like gravity, I said. It's not a product of my head. It doesn't speak, but nonetheless commands attention. And I don't care what it means or who decorates the scenes. The problem is more with my sense of pride, because it keeps me thinking of me instead of what it is to be. I'm not a passenger, I am the ride. I'm not a passenger.